It's just so crazy. And everybody lies. No one's telling the truth because they're afraid, because they're all doing something criminal. Everyone's involved in something a little illegal. So no one's being honest, 100% honest.
One of the reasons this case has always been so difficult to make any headway in is the shortage of reliable narrators. And that's true in a lot of cases, but it's especially true in this one. Most of the time, these things that people aren't telling the truth about, they're not even about the murders. Or at least they're not primarily about the murders. They're lies that have been told to cover up other crimes or trivial secrets. And all too often, they're lies that have seemingly been told for no reason other than to make this case that much harder to figure out.
God, that's bizarre. Why would he lie about that?
Like, I feel like now I have to like rule this out. Like, I can't just like be like, oh, okay, it's probably nothing.
No, it's something.
That is not at all how I expected that to play out. He has nothing to hide. Like, he's...
I thought he was going to be really forthcoming. Yeah, he's such a minor character. But then...
I do not understand how... this case. Like...
Everyone is hiding something.
These lies and half-truths are a big reason why even some of the most basic factual issues in this case have been so hard to pin down. And it's that shaky factual foundation that allowed the prosecution in Jeff Titus's trial to rewrite the story from the ground up, and to tell a version of events that points at Titus's guilt, but has little connection to reality. That's why Bruce Worsema and Roy Ballett, the original detectives in this case, did something unusual after finding out about the conviction. They went to the Michigan Innocence Clinic and asked them to take Jeff Titus's case. It was the first and last time that the attorneys at the Michigan Innocence Clinic had a case brought to them by members of law enforcement.
Are you hopeful? Are you holding out hope that someday Jeff Titus will get a new trial or be exonerated?
I'm hopeful he'll get a new trial for certain, yeah, absolutely. Exoneration, that's up to, you know, the court again. But I'd like to see him base it on something, some foundation. Roy calls it smoke and mirrors. You know, conviction on smoke and mirrors.
Somewhere along the line, that evidence got stretched to a very, very thin line and was incorrect to the point where the prosecuting attorney has a certain obligation to see that justice is done.
And if you unstretch those truths and take the smoke and mirrors away, you start to see a case that's very different from the one that Jeff Titus' jury saw.
Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed. This is The State versus Jeff Titus. Today's episode, episode 15, will be the second to last episode in our series on this case. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of Adnan Story, and I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Let's start with one of the most brazen lies in this case, one that has been told again and again by the cold case team and the prosecution.
Then he takes the gun of Estes, cleans it spotless. Even the owner's prints were not on that weapon. I mean, come on.
At Titus's trial, detectives testified that the gun was, quote, absolutely clean, and that it had been, quote, wiped clean of any prints. Otherwise, prints would have been found on it. The trial judge bought into it, too. He cited the gun being wiped clean of prints as factual support for a number of his rulings. And this claim has been repeated so often that it's almost become a mantra in this case, accepted by even Titus's most strident defenders.
The shotgun probably had been found in taken away and brought back, because my understanding is the outside of it was clear of fingerprints. And that means somebody did something to it to remove suspicion of something.
Except it doesn't. That doesn't mean what Stan assumed it did. Guns are extremely difficult objects to collect latent prints from. They're often textured or treated to prevent corrosion, and the fact that no prints were found on the shotgun does not suggest that any effort was made to intentionally remove prints. A 1997 study in the Journal of Forensic Identification looked at this question of how often prints are left behind on firearms that have been recovered as evidence, and it found that out of 1,000 firearms that were forensically examined, latent prints had been recovered from only 93 of them. That's less than 10%. A 2010 study obtained similar results, finding that latent prints had been obtained from 12% of firearms recovered for processing. And a 2012 study found that latent prints had been recovered from a whopping 13% of firearms examined. Besides, on at least four separate occasions, four different law enforcement officials who examined the shotgun after it was found noted in their reports that the gun had not been cleaned. The gun had been dirty, outside and in.
Let's take a look at another assumption that the cold case team based its investigation on, that the motive for this crime could not have been robbery. Bennett's wallet had been pulled from his back pocket. The cash had been stolen, and the wallet's other contents had been discarded in the forest floor. But the cold case team and the prosecution told the jury that this was because someone had staged the scene to make it look like a robbery. The cold case team concluded that no one who wanted to commit a robbery would choose to target a victim who was openly armed. And to be fair to the cold case team, they're not the only ones who think that. In 2001, the cold case team met with the FBI's profiling experts in Quantico to discuss this case. And notes from that meeting describe how, according to the FBI's profile, the murders at the Fulton game area could not have been motivated by drugs or money because, quote, offenders don't commit armed robbery against someone with a gun. But that's simply not true.
Have you seen the case of Chong Yang? He was killed in 2018 in a public hunting area near Lansing.
No, I haven't.
He was out hunting. He was shot in the back and robbed. They still haven't solved it.
See, that's going to be hard to solve.
On this, cold case detective Mike Brown is right. These cases are hard to solve. And hunters do get targeted for robbery. There are plenty of cases that show this. Florida, 1993. Two deer hunters shot in the back and robbed. 5 days and 40 miles apart. Michigan, also 1993. A bow hunter shot in the hunting blind, his wallet and car keys taken. Ohio, 1995. Two brothers out deer hunting, a half mile apart from one another, both shot in the back and robbed.
Would you agree that it's possible that one of these hunter-killer robbers could have targeted Fulton that day and just...
No. I mean, a spaceship could have come down or something.
But spaceships don't land a lot. Hunters do get killed and robbed.
Yeah, they do.
Yes, it is rare for hunters to be killed and robbed. But it's even rarer for landowners to kill trespassing hunters. Most of the time when a hunter is intentionally killed, the motive turns out to be a hunting dispute between hunters. But robbery can't be ruled out here.
And actually, the FBI rejected the cold case team's theory that the crime scene in this case had been intentionally staged. This does not meet criteria for staging, the cold case team's notes from Quantico read. But the notes show that the FBI profilers did conclude that Jeff Titus was the most viable suspect in this case. But why, though? What evidence convinced the Behavioral Science Unit that it was Jeff Titus who committed these murders? Opinion was Jeff Titus based primarily on location, the Quantico notes state. Biggest thing, location is important to offender. Location is central to who has interest, equals Mr. Titus. As a result, the FBI concluded, not emotion, money, drugs, but the trespassing is why victims were killed. But the location where the FBI thought the murders had occurred was wrong. They were never told where the bodies had actually been found, and neither was the jury at Jeff Titus' trial.
Now, to the best of our understanding, in reading the trial transcript and
my recollection when I visited this area some period of time after the homicides in 1990, this is approximately where the homicides were committed.
Following Jeff Titus' conviction, his friend, alibi, and hunting companion, Stan Driscoll, began his own investigation and used a camcorder to document important locations in the case, including the crime scene.
This is to the north. Now we're pointing east, and here is the Titus field.
Stan is standing on state game land in this video, but he's very close to Titus' property line. From where Stan is, you could easily toss a rock over and inhabit land on Titus' field. And if the murders had occurred here, you can see why an investigator would immediately wonder if there had been some kind of connection between the murders and the Titus farm. But the place Stan is recording this video is not where the murders occurred. The actual site of the murders is at least 220 feet behind Stan, deeper into the game area. It's not surprising, though, that Stan got the location so badly wrong here. Stan had been trying to reconstruct where the crime scene was, based on how it was described in trial testimony. And at no point in Titus's trial was the crime scene location accurately described. But there were plenty of incorrect descriptions of the crime scene that described the murders as happening right next to Titus's land. So just going off what's in the transcripts, yeah, it makes sense that's where Stan went to film the video. But Stan's determination of the crime scene location had not been based off of the transcripts alone. Jeff had also shown him where it was.
He took me to the crime scene, showed me where it was. It actually turned out to be a bit closer to his property than the actual crime scene itself, because where Seema went back there with the Innocence Clinic of the University of Michigan, and he pointed out where the crime occurred, which was actually probably 20 to 30 yards further in than what Jeff pointed out to me. Jeff had it about 10 yards from the border of his property.
So where Jeff understood the crime to be was different than where the police officer said it was.
Yeah, Jeff obviously did not really know where the crime occurred, because he did indicate to me a location that differed from the actual location.
If the place that Jeff Titus thinks is the location of the crime scene is actually not the right location, then where do the detectives think the right location is?
We're at the edge of Titus's property, and we're about 20 yards from the crime scene.
In the Killer in Question episode on Jeff Titus's case, there's a scene where cold case detective Mike Workema takes the film crew out to a spot that he says is where the murders occurred. The documentary team also filmed, separately, Detective Worsima, who also took them out to the crime scene location. And when I was in Michigan last year with Jacinda and Kevin, they took me to the game area and showed me that same spot in the woods where they had filmed with both Worsima and Workema.
Did they seem confident at the time they were the right place?
At first they were like, I don't know. And then they both walked around a bit and they landed on the same spot.
The place where the detectives took the film crew to is close to Jeff Titus's property. Titus's fields are plainly visible, and it feels like if you were walking along through the woods there, you wouldn't have to stray too far out of your way to end up on his side of the property line. I can kinda sorta see how someone who was really confused about property lines might think that Titus's property line could have stretched out that far, maybe. But by the time we made this visit to the game area, I'd spent a lot of time already staring at maps of these woods. And this patch of woods that Kevin and Jacinda showed me did not match the one objective record that we have about where the murders actually took place. That record is a crime scene sketch made by Deputy Tom Harmson on the night of the murders. His sketch is the only one ever made based on actual measurements taken on site. And the location marked in Deputy Harmson's diagram is about a football field and a half behind where Workema and Worsima took the film crew.
All right. Based on what I think I remember, the crime scene has to be like right up here.
One patch of woods looks very much like another, though. That's why there's been so much confusion over this. Trying to pinpoint the exact location where the murders occurred was not easy.
So I'm looking for the two trees that Bennett fell between. And they may have fallen down since then. It's all I can think of. Not this guy. Oh, a bug just went down my throat.
I didn't find the trees I was looking for on that first trip to the Fulton game area, or the second trip, or the third. And I'm 99% sure that all the original trees that were used to mark locations at the crime scene have since died out or been cut down. But with a little help, Jacinda and I were eventually able to find the crime scene.
Ron Elwell owns the property to the north of Jeff Titus's farm, and he is the only known witness, aside from Mark Perry and Doug's stepson, Bobby Brown, who saw the crime scene while it was still daylight. He offered to take Jacinda and Susan back to that same spot in the woods, where he'd waited with Mark Perry 30 years ago.
My best guess would have been right probably in this area.
Huh. We are so close to the swamp here.
Yeah, it's, I don't think it would have been any farther back in.
So you wouldn't, you're pretty sure it's not like all the way other side of the field over there?
No. In fact, I don't even remember even being able to see the field. If one fellow went under, looked about like that.
So
was laying about like that there.
You are going about to a spot where, like, based on the maps, or they're not maps, they're instructions, like land, right somewhere in this.
Okay.
371 feet from that big rock.
Oh, from the rock?
From the big rock, yeah, at an angle. I went on Google Earth and, like, diagrammed it, and it came up here every time. So, like, technically, the bodies were almost as close to your property as to his?
Yeah. Yeah, if you went on that diagonal right off that corner, it was pretty close.
No one walking around back where the murders occurred could ever have been confused about whether this patch of woods was somehow on Jeff Titus's property. For one thing, it's just not close to Titus's property line. For another, no room had been left for confusion.
Who's supposed to be confused?
Titus got confused and they were on his land, so he killed them. That's a theory.
Oh, Jeff knows it. Jeff would have known where his boundaries were. I can tell you that that sign that you read, with the little metal sign.
The no trespassing sign.
Jeff put those up.
So he knew exactly where it was.
He knew exactly where the line was. Jeff had run a piece of electrical wire or something all the way down through here.
Oh, it's still there. It goes all the way up.
Just like the no trespassing signs, the wire fence line had been in place there on November 17th, 1990. One of the ambulance attendees described how, while carrying the bodies out from the crime scene to the ambulance that was parked in Titus's field, they'd had to carefully climb over this wire fence line. Jim Bennett and Doug Estes were not killed because of any confusion over where Titus's property began. Because there never was any confusion over where Titus's property began.
It's not only where the murders occurred that's been obscured in this case, it's also when.
In this particular scenario, there can't be an exact timeline. All of those people out there in the woods are not keeping track of time. When it gets too dark to hunt, you walk out of the woods. That's a simple law of nature.
By triangulating off of the few fixed points that we know for certain, though, we can narrow the window of possible times down. And we know that Doug's stepson, Bobby Brown, must have found the bodies no later than about 5:20 p.m., because there had still been plenty of daylight out. And almost everyone agrees that the two shots had been fired at least 20 minutes before they heard Bobby's cries for help, so no later than about 5 p.m. at the very latest. But based on the timelines given by other hunters at the game area, it's possible the murders had been committed earlier too. And it's these witnesses that cold case detective Mike Workema believed, because he ended up going with a theory of Titus's guilt that required the murders to have taken place at 4:30 p.m. or earlier. So that's the cold case team's official theory of when it happened. Except there was one glaring problem with Workema's theory. Jim Bennett's girlfriend, Kimber, told police that when Jim walked out of their trailer that night to go hunting, she looked at the clock in their VCR, and the time was 4:38 p.m.
Workema ultimately went down and talked to her because he established a timeline that it had to have happened within this. He went down there and talked to her, and all of a sudden it wasn't 4:36. They forgot to set their clocks back, and it was actually 3:36.
The report from Workema's interview with Kimber says that Kimber agreed she'd forgotten to change the time on the VCR clock, which would mean Jim left the house at 3:38 p.m.
He's the one that got her to change her mind. So
she's not changed her mind that much.
When we talked to her, she was like, I don't think that happened.
Yeah, oh, when we talked to her, she was like...
No, and she said that to Gwen Romanek. That cop came down here and, you know, told me I didn't change my clock back. And no, she says, that's the clock we got up, you know, and went to work with. We had one in the bedroom and one in the living room. And that's the clock that we worked off of. And she told Gwen, no, that he had me so confused.
The cold case team had been convinced that Kimber was wrong about what time Jim left his trailer that day, and that the real time had been an hour before, because they claimed that if Jim had left at 4:38 p.m., he wouldn't have made it to the game area before the murders happened. So, Jacinda and Susan decided to test out whether the 4:38 timeline was really as impossible as the cold case team claimed.
And we're there.
7:21.
And then 7 minute walk back. 4:38 was doable. He gets here at 4:45. 7 minute walk back.
A little before five.
4:52 p.m. He gets there. He probably gets shot right away. Kimber was right.
Kimber was right.
Shortly before he left his trailer that afternoon, Jim Bennett had received a phone call. He talked for about 10 minutes, and after hanging up, he told his girlfriend's 11-year-old daughter, Mandy, that he was going up to the game area in Fulton. Someone had told him the hunting was good there, he said. Not long after that, Kimber arrived home from work. Jim let her know he was heading out to go hunting, but that he wouldn't be gone long. He'd be back in time for their dinner plans that evening. I'm going to where the deer are, Jim told her as he walked out the trailer door. The time was 4:38 p.m. Less than 20 minutes later, he was dead. The Fulton game area had been known as a dangerous place to hunt. That's why Jim Bennett never hunted there before. He'd even told a number of friends that they should avoid the Fulton game area, that it was a bad place to hunt. But on November 17th, someone changed Jim Bennett's mind. Someone called Jim Bennett and told him to go to the Fulton game area. That someone has never come forward to identify themselves, even though it was their advice, inadvertently or otherwise, that led to Jim's death.
We know a lot about what Doug Estes did on that Saturday in November. We know where he went, who he saw, what he did. We can put together a pretty complete timeline of his day. The same cannot be said, though, for Jim Bennett. And in part, that's because the Kalamazoo County detectives only conducted a small part of that investigation. Jim Bennett was from Leonidas in St. Joseph County, and most of the witnesses who knew him lived there as well. Which is why, starting in early December, Detective Larry Moyer from the St. Joe County Sheriff's Department had been brought in to handle that side of the investigation. And there are some very notable gaps in the investigation into witnesses in St. Joe County. For instance, there's no record of any detective from the original investigation ever interviewing Kimber's daughter, Amanda, or Mandy as she'd been known, even though she'd been with Jim at the trailer for most of that afternoon. The first record of an interview with Mandy would not be until 2000, when the cold case team spoke to her. But Mandy told us that she had been interviewed by a detective shortly after the murders happened.
So he was the same one that come out all the time, and I finally told my mom, I said, he makes me nervous.
Although there's no written report from these interviews with Mandy, it seems that Detective Moyer had thought Mandy might be an important witness.
And he's like, can I talk to you? And I was like, why? I was like, you already talked to me.
Right.
So.
But it's weird, like, he must have known your mom worked evening. So, like, is he timing it for when?
Yeah, I don't know. He was always asking me the same thing over and over. Asked me if I knew where Jim was that night and if anybody went hunting with him. And I said, I don't know. I said, I didn't go with him.
This question of who Jim Bennett was hunting with that day is an important one, but no attempt was ever made to put together a definitive account of where Jim Bennett hunted, who he hunted with, or where the people he'd hunted with had been that afternoon. What we know for certain, or just about, is that Jim Bennett spent the first 2.5 days of deer season hunting on his family's property. The Bennett family had an airfield on 120 acres just north of Leonidas. Jim and his girlfriend Kimber lived in a trailer behind the airfield off of Lawrence Road, so Jim didn't have to go far to go hunting. And the Bennett property was a good place to hunt. If you were going to get a deer anywhere, you'd get one there. Which is why, on opening day, on Thursday, November 15th, There'd probably been a score of people out there hunting, both members of the Bennett family and family friends who'd been given permission to hunt the grounds.
So I always hunted out at the Bennett's and always got a deer opening morning. I seemed to be the first one, then always have to help everyone else get a deer.
That's Skeeter Cerny. He'd been a family friend of the Bennett's for years. He'd been particularly close with Jim Bennett's brother-in-law, Jerry Waters. Though several witnesses told us that Jim and Skeeter might have had a professional relationship, too.
That's a lot of weeds.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Does he have people working for him?
I don't know. I'm not sure. You might want to talk to Skeeter. Skeeter would know more.
Skeeter and Jim hadn't always gotten along, though. According to Jim's father and brother, Jim had ended up banning Skeeter from hunting on the Bennett family property. Though what exactly Skeeter had done to cause Jim to ban him is never mentioned in any of the witness statements that we have. But on opening day in 1990, Skeeter had apparently not yet been banned because Skeeter was seen hunting there by a number of people.
And no one ever asked me to take a lie detector test. And then when they asked Brent Birch, there's a guy you ought to talk to is Brent Birch.
He
was more friends with the Bennett's than I was.
That opening day, the airfield had been crowded. But by Saturday, November 17th, things had calmed down a bit. A much smaller group of people was out hunting on the Bennett property.
The other day it happened. I hunted with him that day.
Strictly speaking, what Skeeter says here isn't true, or at least I don't think it is. According to both Jim's brother and father, Jim had been hunting with them that morning. But they had bumped into another group of hunters that were hunting nearby, possibly on a neighboring property, and that hunting party had included Skeeter.
Who all was out there that day?
Oh, God, there was me, I think, like I said, Brent. What's his name? Brent, me. Standish, Chris Standish, was with us and his son.
Jim's dad told investigators that after running into Skeeter's hunting party, they'd all chatted for a bit. Skeeter and Brent had invited Jim to go hunting with them later that afternoon, possibly over by the Nottowa River area. The Bennett family had continued hunting till around noon, at which point, having had no luck in getting a deer, they decided to call it quits. Jack and Fred headed over to the bar, while Jim went back to his trailer to take a nap before heading out to hunt again that afternoon.
So you just thought everyone was going to lunch or something, and then they'd go meet up again?
Right, that's what we were supposed to do, meet up again and go hunting. But there was also a bunch of guys that were drinking, and they didn't want to be around that.
With the guns?
With the guns, yeah, and then he gets shot.
There's a curious question raised by this sequence of events that's never directly addressed in the case file. Jim's family told investigators that at some point, Jim had banned Skeeter from hunting on their property. But as of the morning of opening day in 1990, it seems like Skeeter had not yet been banned, because multiple witnesses describe him hunting there. This would imply that whatever it was that Skeeter had done to get banned from hunting on the Bennett farm, it must have happened sometime between opening day, on November 15th, and the day that Jim died, 2 days later, on the 17th. While there's no definitive answer in the case file, there are a few reports that hint at what the problem may have been. 9 days after the murders, Carl McDonald, a shop owner in Leonidas, called in a tip to a St. Joe County detective. He had some information he thought the investigators should be aware of, he said. According to Carl McDonald, on opening day, there had been some kind of argument between Brent Birch and Jim Bennett over a deer. And on Saturday, the day of the murders, Brent Birch had been hunting at the Fulton Game area with two other hunters. The next day, the St. Joe County Sheriff's Department got a call from someone else in Leonidas who said that he had some information he thought might be important to the investigators. On Saturday morning, the man said, Jim Bennett had been hunting with Skeeter Cerny in Leonidas when one of them shot a deer. But then Brent Birch had also shot the deer and tried to claim it for himself. They'd argued, and it ended with Brent telling Jim and Skeeter that he was going to get them. After that argument, Skeeter and Bennett had made plans to go hunt at the Fulton Game area that afternoon. And according to the caller, Brent Birch had known that's where they'd be. After receiving these calls, a detective from St. Joe County went to talk to Skeeter. The complete report of the interview reads as follows.
Skeeter denied any such incident having occurred, was not able to substantiate this report.
Did Brent Birch get a deer that day?
No.
There was a garbled story many years later about how, like, maybe Brent and Jim were fighting over a deer that Brent killed.
Does that ring any bells?
No.
They
we
never.
Used to, we bugged Brent about he shot a doe that was about as big as a dog. Was that somebody blasted holes in it? But it was the last day of hunting season, and but I don't think it was that year. I know it wasn't that year. Yeah, it was a small deer or something, and he shot it just because it was the last day and he wanted to shoot something. I think at least get a deer.
I heard someone refer to those kind of deer as a suitcase deers.
There you go. That it work. Just something he got teased about.
Oh, so it wasn't even like angry. It was just like,
right.
Really got it.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Brant shoot a dog.
Jacinda and Susan also asked Brent Birch about the incident with the doe, though Brent had not wanted to be recorded.
And he was pretty tense.
He was pretty tense. He didn't want to answer any questions.
He did admit that the fight was that year, though, about the doe, and that that Jim was actually angry.
Yeah.
When Skeeter had lied and covered up for him.
The first time Skeeter was ever asked about his alibi was not until years after the murders, when he was given a polygraph exam. There's no record of what Skeeter told the polygraph examiner, though. In fact, in the entire case file, the only statement from Skeeter about where he was that day comes from the report of his interview in 2000 with the cold case team.
Cerny stated that the reason they didn't get back together to hunt was that either he or someone else called Jim Bennett's trailer in the afternoon and found out that Bennett had gone out hunting by himself. Later in the conversation, he stated that he believed that he, Chris Standish, and Brent Birch had gone hunting at a place called Lash Bridge, and that possibly Brent Birch got a deer that day, and that's why they stopped hunting at that point. Skeeter did not remember the fact that he had made a previous statement to a polygraph examiner about going hunting in a different location later in the day until Detective Sergeant Brown brought up his original statement to the polygraph examiner.
In addition to the reports alleging Brent and Skeeter and Jim had some kind of dispute over a deer, there also been several reports, or maybe just rumors, that claimed that Brent Birch had been seen at the Fulton game area on Saturday afternoon. So a couple weeks after the murders, Detective Wersema called Brent up to set up an interview and asked him where he'd been that day. In his report, Detective Wersema noted that, in this initial phone call, Brent told him that he'd been hunting with a friend named Chris Standish that day. He denied that he'd been at the game area, though. "I didn't even know you could hunt on state land," he told Detective Wersema. "I thought it was off-limits to hunt there. I just hunt around Leonidas." A day or two later, Detective Wersema interviewed Brent in person. His report on this interview is brief.
Brent attempted to establish what he was doing on Saturday afternoon and evening, November 17, 1990, however could not remember particulars, but did report he was with Kevin Myers.
Like Skeeter, Brent was brought in at some point later and given a polygraph exam. Once again, we have no record of this polygraph itself, but it is mentioned in the cold case team's report of their interview with him.
Brent Birch advised me that the day that Jim Bennett died, he believed that he went hunting with Skeeter Cerny. He stated that everything about that day, since it was now 10 years ago, was very difficult for him to remember. He had indicated that if I wanted further information, I should read the statement given to the polygraph examiner. I had already read that statement, and it indicated that the time when he took the polygraph examination, he told the examiner that everything about that day was fuzzy. Birch stated he thought he hunted with other people along with Skeeter Cerny, but couldn't recall who they were. He wasn't exactly sure where they hunted. Birch stated that he thought they went to Lash Bridge to hunt, but he recalled Jim Bennett saying he was going to hunt in the Fulton game area. Birch stated that he believed it was just him and Skeeter Cerny who went to Lash Bridge in the afternoon to hunt.
Neither Skeeter nor Brent were able to give investigators a consistent answer about where they were when Jim Bennett and Doug Estes were killed. So, in trying to piece together the gaps in their memories, our best bet is to look to the other people who may have been with them that day. Let's start with Chris Standish. That's who Brent had said he was with in his very first statement. And Chris is also who Skeeter told the cold case team that he'd been with that day, and he told the same thing to Jacinda and me. When I talked to Chris, he'd confirmed that he had indeed been hunting with Brent and Skeeter over near the Bennett property. Chris's stepson had been with them as well. And Chris recalled how, at some point that morning, they'd bumped into a few members of the Bennett family and talked to them for a bit. But then, at about 10 a.m., Skeeter had shot a deer, so Chris had gone off with Skeeter to get the deer checked and processed over in Union City. After that, Chris and Skeeter had gone their separate ways, and Chris has no idea what Skeeter or Brent did afterwards. And then Chris added, There were some other people too out there at the Bennett Farm on opening day, but I don't know who they all were. Wait, I said, opening day? Opening day was the 15th. You mean opening Saturday, right? November 17th? No, Chris said. This had been an opening day. That was the only day I hunted with Brent and Skeeter.
Chris had also been interviewed back in 1990, and his statements then were largely consistent with what he told Susan in 2020. From what Chris remembers, he'd hunted with Skeeter and Brent at the Bennett Farm on opening day that year, and only on opening day that year. But Skeeter told Jacinda and Susan that he shot a deer on Saturday morning.
And I sat there and got a deer early in the morning and went and turned it in, and then come back, then it was all supposed to push a cornfield. Then we waited on him, and he just never showed up.
It's possible that Chris's memory is wrong, and that it was in fact Saturday, not Thursday, that he'd hunted with Skeeter and Brent. But even still, even if it was the Saturday that they'd hunted together, Chris is not an alibi witness for Skeeter and Brent. Because Chris is clear that on whatever day it was that he hunted with Skeeter and Brent, he'd hunt with them only in the morning, and not in the afternoon, when the murders occurred. Maybe that's why, in Brent's second statement to investigators, he changed his story. He told Rosima that he'd actually been hunting with his friend Kevin that day. So Jacinda and Susan went to talk to Kevin to see what he remembered.
All right.
Do you remember the murders over the Fulton State game area?
Yeah, I sure do. I seen it on TV where they found that guy. Because, yeah, me and my son was there hunting.
I had not been expecting Kevin to tell me that he'd been at the Fulton game area that day. When he'd been interviewed in 1990, he'd said that he and Brent had hunted a place called the Kiwanis Woods that afternoon, which, from the Bennett property, is in the opposite direction of the Fulton game area. I wasn't sure if Kevin had simply misspoken or was remembering things wrong, so I asked him to walk me through where all they'd hunted that day.
But you think you were with Brent all day?
I know we were all together. Yeah, we were all together all day. Yeah. But then I remember getting home that night, and it was that night or maybe the next day, to where somebody had gotten shot up there. And I tell you the truth, I really didn't see Brent until maybe a week or two after that, okay? But he was with us. I mean, if there's any scrutiny over, he was had nothing to do with it.
Kevin told us he hadn't even heard about the murders until sometime later on, when a report came on the news about it.
Seen it on the TV, and it's like, Fulton, you know, it was on Fox, and they seen it as Fulton, like, you know, we were up there, you know, so it was just kind of ringing a bell, and wow, you know, we were close to some type of situation that happened, and then the detective come up there, like, so wow, it just freaked me out. He looked at me, and I remember he asked me, well, did you do it?
Like, he asked you?
Yeah. He asked me, and I'm sitting across the table, well, did you do it? And he was really serious. It's like, well, no.
Why would he ask you? I've never.
Yeah, he did. He come right out there and asked me if I did it.
I've never heard your suggestion to someone who did it.
So yep, he did. There's two men.
But why would he ask you that? Like, well, that seems like a weird question to ask someone.
Well, because they were in a murder investigation.
But you don't go around like asking everyone you see, did you do it?
Yeah, that's
you're
exactly.
You're going to say no. You have to ask other questions.
Did you do it? And it's like, well, you know, I was there with my son.
Kevin actually seems to have a pretty good memory of the day that he hunted with Brent Birch. He can still give a rough account of events, starting with what happened when they woke up that morning, and ending when he and his son returned to their own home that night. And he remembers some pretty specific details.
And yeah, I just remember the one spot that we got into, I got into was a bullpen. And I ended up jumping over a fence because there was a bull out there. And after running and getting out of the thing before that bull came out at me, that was an experience.
What's confusing, though, is that Kevin's memory of what happened on this hunting trip has essentially no resemblance whatsoever to the statement that he gave the police back in 1990.
So back then, you said, you told them, you don't mention your son being there. You mentioned Chris Standish, and Chris Standish's son being there?
I don't know who Chris Standish is.
And you said that you hunted with him around noon, you went to the Bennett's airfield, then about 1:30, you went to Chris Standish's house, and you stayed with Chris Standish. They went to Minden to get some beer. And then hunt at the Kiwanis Woods?
God, I don't remember any of that.
Actually, no one else remembered any of that either. Even in 1990, Kevin's statement had been an outlier. Chris Standish didn't recall any of what Kevin described, and neither did Brent.
They ran to guys by the airfield near Bennett's property. So you were near Bennett's property, it sounds like?
Yeah, where we met the guys with the bridges.
At the airfield?
I don't remember airfield.
Did you know Jim Bennett?
No.
Did you know the Bennetts?
No, is this the people that got killed or something?
Yeah.
No, I have no idea.
You know Skeeter Cerny?
No, I don't, to be honest with you, I don't know anybody that's up there whatsoever.
Kevin doesn't recall the Bennetts or the Bennett airfield or any of the people that Brent and Skeeter say were in their hunting party that day. Though, Kevin does remember that there was someone else who'd been hunting with him and Brent.
And that night, Filipino Danny was with us too, I believe. I think he came up or something.
This part of Kevin's memory matches the statement of at least one other witness. In 1990, Jim Bennett's brother Terry had told police that on the day Jim was killed, he'd driven by the bridges that Kevin's talking about, and Terry says he'd seen Brent, Danny, and Skeeter all hunting there together. So Kevin's memory of hunting with Brent and Danny down by the bridges kind of makes sense. But the rest of what Kevin told us is very hard to make sense of. His story was somewhat nonlinear, and through the course of our conversation, he contradicted himself several times. For instance, Kevin initially told us that he and Brent and Danny had all gone out somewhere to hunt at dusk after they got done pushing a cornfield.
But it seems like you had a sense that Brent was their person of interest.
Well, Brent could be a shady character, okay? And I never spent any more time with him. You know what I mean? I just didn't. I kind of felt maybe he was shady. But we were never, you know, he was not in any place that, I think we left that night. I don't think we even hunted that night. We left that because we just wore out from running the fields, you know. Uh-huh. And we left that night and it didn't go back.
According to Kevin, he'd been pretty freaked out when those detectives showed up on his doorstep. He'd seen on TV that there'd been a murder at the place he'd been hunting at, and then, the next day, suddenly the police are there, wanting to talk to him about it.
Were you aware that you were an alibi for Brent, potentially?
No, I had no idea, but okay. I've never talked to him since.
Really?
I've never talked to him since then, no. Hmm. No, and then no, you know, I had no reason to.
Had you ever heard suggested that Brent Birch might have been involved in this case?
One thing I will just tell you about Brent is that, and I didn't really realize it until, he was homeless pretty much, living with his dad, and I kind of recognized that he was homeless, living with his dad, and he didn't have much. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one thing that I noticed, and it's like, you know, I was, you know, it's time to go home, and that's pretty much what I did, you know. Yeah, that's pretty much what I did.
But did you ever hear him talk about that he might have done this or been involved
somewhere? No, I never seen him since then.
Okay.
I never seen him.
You literally never saw him again?
No, I never seen him again. I never seen him again.
Kevin had started off our conversation by telling us that he'd been hunting at the Fulton Game Area when the murders occurred, a claim I'm still not sure what to make of. Later on, though, towards the end of our conversation, Kevin ended up walking back what he'd said.
This wouldn't even cross my mind. It never crossed my mind about that, other than seeing it on TV, realizing that we were there. But then again, hey, I'm thinking that that's Kalamazoo, that's way, you know, that's way up there. We weren't nowhere near that. Even when we took off running the things, we were probably within 2 miles, 3 miles of Leandas. Uh-huh. We weren't very far out, you know. We just weren't, you know.
The Fulton Game Area is roughly 3.6 miles north of where Brent Birch's father lived. So, if Kevin and Brent and Danny really had been there, then Kevin would be right. They hadn't been very far out from Leonidas. Hearing from Kevin had done little to clear up our confusion about where Brent Birch was on the day of the murders. But Kevin had given us the name of someone else who had been with him and Brent that day. Their friend Danny. So Jacinda and I went to talk to Danny in the hopes that this third potential alibi witness might be able to give us some answers. Instead, we left that interview more confused than ever.
He thinks Brent Birch did it.
He thinks Brent Birch did it. Yeah. He just assumed he was in jail for it.
When we started talking to Danny, we'd been able to establish that, yes, Danny had once known Brent Birch, and yes, maybe he and Brent had gone fishing together once or twice. And maybe it was possible that he vaguely remembered some kind of murder thing that may have happened many years ago, but that's about all Danny said he recalled. But then Danny asked us, "So, Brent's finally getting out, huh?" It had taken me a bit to catch on, and then I realized that Danny was under the impression that Brent Birch was convicted of committing these murders, because he'd heard from someone that they'd caught the guy who'd done it. Unfortunately, Danny's memory of relevant events turned out to be extremely limited.
I like how he's pulling in the old card for why he couldn't remember.
I'm 60. I have dementia. No, you don't.
Danny told us that he did not remember ever being interviewed by the police in connection with some kind of murder case. But maybe he really did have dementia because his friend Kevin had no problem recalling it.
Because when I talked to Danny, they had went to Danny's house.
They had already been to his
house. Yeah, they'd went to his house, and it's like, wow, you know what I mean? This is really serious. They think we did it or something.
So they had already talked to Danny before you, you're pretty sure.
They had talked to Danny, and Danny was telling me about it, and like he was really paranoid about it because it's like, wow, they think we did it. Who is this Brent guy? You know, and we don't really know Brent real well. Right. Okay.
In attempting to puzzle out the alibis of Skeeter Cerny and Brent Birch, there's something that cold case prosecutor Steve Fitton told the documentary team that comes to mind.
Alibi had holes in it. It was not airtight. It was Swiss cheese.
Fitton had been talking about Jeff Titus' alibi witness, Dan Driscoll, but if Fitton thought that Titus' alibi was Swiss cheese, then what the heck did he think of the alibis of Skeeter Cerny and Brent Birch? After all, discovering that Jeff Titus had been hunting in a different blind from Stan Driscoll was, supposedly, the big discovery that the cold case team had made to crack this case. But there are much bigger problems with the alibis of Skeeter and Brent, and for that matter, everyone else they were hunting with. These alibi problems go beyond what can be explained away as mere lapses in memory. Yet, the cold case team never gave their alibis a second look. Actually, I'm not sure it can be said that they even gave them a first look. A false alibi can't be simply assumed to imply guilt. It especially can't be assumed to imply that in this case, because there are several different suspects who've lied about their alibis. And they obviously can't all have done the murders. For a couple of those suspects, it turned out they hadn't even been lying because they were worried about the murder case. They lied because their alibi had been that they were hunting illegally on private land, and they hadn't wanted to admit that to detectives. Which is why they falsely stated they'd been hunting somewhere they weren't. So, while false alibis do complicate an investigation and raise questions that need to be answered, they're not necessarily significant either. But just to make things that much more difficult to untangle, sometimes witnesses don't just come up with stories about where they had been when the murder happened. Sometimes they also come up with stories about where other people had been when the murder happened.
Brent Skeet?
Yeah.
They lie their asses off. Okay. I mean, they told the detective that I went hunting with them. I don't even own a gun. What was it going to do, spit at the deer and kill it?
That's Greg Ryan. He was not a suspect in this case initially, but he became a suspect about a year after the murders, after the detectives were given some new information that implicated him in the killings.
What now?
Apparently Greg Ryan told Skeeter Cerny about 3 weeks ago this, that Greg Ryan was the last person to see Jim Bennett alive.
Yeah.
Not true?
No.
According to Skeeter and Brent, Greg Ryan had stopped by Jim's trailer that afternoon to carry out a transaction that the two of them had prearranged.
On the day of the murders, you came by, like, around noon and bought $500 worth of weed?
No, shit, no.
Was there...
Who came up with that shit?
I think it was, like, Skeeter?
Greg Ryan said he bought weed from Bennett on occasion, but it was only an ounce here or there, once a month or so, and never in quantities as large as Brent and Skeeter claimed. Greg Ryan says he did not ever go over to Jim Bennett's trailer on the day he died. And he absolutely had not gone hunting with Jim Bennett, either on that day or any other.
So I don't know what to say that way.
Yeah.
But like I say, Skeet Cerny and Brent Birch said I went hunting that afternoon. Something not right about that. I don't know.
As a result of Skeeter and Brent's statements, Greg Ryan had ended up getting picked up on a warrant out of Texas and sent back to prison there. Detective Terry Van Strain from Kalamazoo had gone down to Texas after him and was able to interview him there, and ultimately had him polygraphed as well. Apparently Greg Ryan passed the polygraph too because the investigation into him was dropped after that. And besides, the only evidence that suggested Greg Ryan might have had anything to do with the Fulton Game Area murders had been these statements coming from Skeeter and Brent. There was never anything else to it. And if what Skeeter and Brent were saying about Greg Ryan had been true, then there should have been a few key pieces of evidence that would corroborate it. And those pieces of evidence don't seem to exist. Plus, Greg Ryan had an alibi, and he also didn't hunt.
Yeah.
You know, when I went to talk to him, when I got out of prison, and a year I had to stay in Texas, I came up here and, you know, I wanted to know why. You know, just like you do. But basically, he locked himself in the trailer and thought it was going to hurt him. You know, I don't like violence. So he finally opened up and he said, Brent made up the lie and I had to back him. And then when I talked to Brent, Brent said, Skeet made up the lie and I had to back him. So they each believed each other, so. Like I say, Skeet, he fucking locked himself in his trailer.
So he, you actually were trying to get in the trailer and he just wouldn't come out?
Yeah, he wouldn't come out. You know, and you know how he opened the door? I said, Skeet, I ain't here to hurt you. I'm here to smoke a joint, drink a beer. Ask him what happened. I said, if you don't open this damn door, I swear to God, I'm going to kick the sumbitch in and beat you with it. And he said, you ain't going to hurt me? No, I ain't going to hurt you. You know, he, as soon as he opened the door, he goes, Brent, it was Brent's idea. Brent, you know. I said, yeah, okay, here, let's smoke a joint. You know, struck me as funny. He's supposed to be a real badass, you know. It's when he's sober, he ain't such a badass, you know.
Before this, Greg Ryan says he never had any particular problems with either Skeeter or Brent.
Like I said, just never understood why they brought me into it.
After he got sent back to Texas, though, he had a lot of time to think things over. And he has his own theories about what happened.
They were supposed to go hunt with Jim Bennett.
They went that morning.
They were supposed to hunt again in the afternoon.
I think they did. And that's why they... See, I think they were there.
Skeeter and Brent had backed up each other's stories when it came to Greg Ryan. But in other things, their stories have never quite aligned. For instance, Skeeter has always denied that there was ever any conflict over a deer. But Brent does not deny that it happened. Skeeter and I legally shot a deer, Brent told us. It wasn't even on the Bennett property, it came off the Bennett property. Skeeter and I shot it. But it was illegal because I didn't have a doe tag. And Jim had been upset about this, Brent said. Jim had voiced his concerns about it. But that was the end of the matter. When he was telling us about this deer incident, Brent Birch kept referring to Skeeter and I shooting the deer, as if somehow they'd both shot it together. But Skeeter says he's the one who got a deer at the Bennett farm that year, and that Brent wasn't involved.
And they always run through the Bennett area there, and like I said, for years I got one, usually open morning, if not the next day.
Is Michigan a one deer state? You get one deer and you're done?
You can get two. You can get a doe. You can send in for a doe permit.
Oh, got it.
It wasn't until I spoke with Chris that I finally began to understand what the conflict with Jim might have really been about. The reports called into the St. Joe County Sheriff's Department back in 1990 had all said the argument had been over a doe, but I don't think that's quite right. Chris told me that while hunting at the Bennett Farm that year, Skeeter had not shot a doe. He'd shot a button buck, a male deer in its first year, whose antlers are only just starting to grow in. And when a buck's horns are under 3 inches, it's considered an antlerless deer. And you have to tag it as a doe, not a buck. But Skeeter did not have a doe permit. Chris did, though, which is why they had to use Chris's doe tag on the button buck. Chris was the one to take it in and pretended he'd been the one to shoot it. And this might explain why Jim Bennett had been so upset. A lot of hunters disapprove of shooting button bucks. After all, button bucks will grow up to be full-grown bucks with full-grown antlers if they're given the chance to do so. Not all hunters feel this way. Some hunters refer to disapproval of shooting small bucks as buck shaming and hold that any deer is a good deer to shoot. But regardless of how you feel about shooting button bucks in general, shooting a button buck on someone else's family property is a rude thing to do, especially when you don't even have a permit for it. It's also a crime. Using someone else's tag on a deer can net you a steep fine and up to 90 days in jail, and loss of hunting privileges for 3 years. And that could explain why no one ever came clean about what that dispute with Jim Bennett had really been about. They hadn't wanted to get Chris and Skeeter in trouble for what had happened to the button buck. What the button buck issue can explain, though, is why no one ever came clean about the phone call that was made to Jim Bennett that day. The one that told him to go hunt in Fulton. No one has ever admitted to making that phone call, and none of Jim's friends have ever identified or even suggested who the call might have come from.
Except that phone call is maybe less of a mystery than it first appeared. Because when Susan asked Cold Case Detective Rich Madison about it, he was confident that he knew who that call had come from.
Kimber Tracy's daughter was home with Bennett in their trailer. Kimber was at work. And the phone rang, and she answered it. And somebody said, yeah, it's Jim there. And she didn't recognize the voice. And she says, who is this? And it was a guy that was nicknamed Skeeter. And she says, it's Skeeter. And she knew Skeeter, then recognized his voice. So she got Jim on the phone, and they talked. And right after he got up off the phone, he grabbed his muzzle loader, and Kimber came in, and he says, I'm going hunting.
5 months after Mandy told the cold case team that it was Skeeter who called Jim that day, the cold case team finally got around to interviewing Skeeter about it. They asked him if he'd called Jim or told him the hunting was good in Fulton, and Skeeter had denied it. So, that was that. No further attempt was made to investigate the source of the phone call. But the cold case team's report of its interview with Mandy is clear. In 2000, she was certain it was Skeeter who had called.
Because he never went there. He always hunted around our area.
Do you remember him getting a phone call that day?
I don't.
Okay.
Mandy's interview with the cold case team happened 20 years ago, and she no longer remembers receiving any phone call. But we know that Mandy had been at the trailer, and that she'd answered other phone calls that came in that day. Because other witnesses, like Mandy's aunt, told investigators back in 1990 that when they'd called the trailer that afternoon, Mandy had answered the phone. And she told them that Jim was still napping.
According to Mandy, she had also been interviewed back in 1990 by Detective Moyer, the investigator from St. Joe County. But if so, he never made a written report about it, and we don't know if Mandy ever gave him the name of who that call had come in from. But Moyer also interviewed Mandy's mother, Kimber, and that report has a curious line in it. Jim Bennett told Mandy he was going hunting in the state park area. Someone told him it was good hunting. Mandy asked who it was that told him that, and was told that it was none of her business. I do wonder, though, if there was something more to Detective Moyer's investigation than is revealed in the written record that we have. Because when we spoke to Brent Birch, I'd asked him, like I'd asked Skeeter, who it was that he'd been hunting with that day. And he gave an answer I hadn't heard before. There was Fred Moyer, Larry Moyer, me, and Skeet Cerny, he said. The answer seemed to come quickly to Brent, and in our brief conversation, he named them a second time as well, as the two other people in their hunting party. And while it was no surprise to hear Brent name Skeeter as someone he was hunting with that day, Fred Moyer and Larry Moyer were not names I expected to hear. Because Fred Moyer and Larry Moyer were brothers, and it was their cousin, Detective Larry Moyer, who investigated this case in St. Joe County. I don't know if Detective Moyer's cousins really were with Skeeter and Brent that day. I can't imagine what possible reason Brent Birch could have to make something like that up, but it's also not a claim I've been able to corroborate either. None of the Moyers involved are alive today, but I spoke to Detective Moyer's son and asked if he remembered his father ever mentioning anything about this case. His dad hadn't talked about his work a lot, he said, but this case was one of the few he'd bring up in conversation from time to time. It was one of his only unsolved murders, Detective Moyer's son said. And his son wondered if maybe that's why his dad still talked about it sometimes, even after he'd retired from the St. Joe County Sheriff's Department. From what his son could recall, Detective Moyer had never mentioned either Skeeter Cerny or Brent Birch in connection with the case. Detective Moyer had known Skeeter, of course. Moyer was from Leonidas, too, and it's a small town. He knew just about everyone there. And Detective Moyer had known Skeeter's brothers well. Skeeter's brother also confirmed that to us. But when Detective Moyer had talked about this case, his son told me, he'd always say that he'd known who'd done it, that he knew who killed Doug Estes and Jim Bennett. He just couldn't quite make the case to prove it, and never could make an arrest. Jim knew the guy who killed him, Detective Moyer told his son more than once. But if Detective Moyer had ever given the name of the suspect that he had in mind, Moyer's son could no longer recall it. The cold case team claims that Jeff Titus staged the crime scene. He made it look like a robbery when it wasn't one. And then he took Doug Estes' shotgun home with him, wiped off his prints, and put it back in the woods. But if Jeff Titus really did all that, then why hadn't he been concerned about leaving prints behind when he went through the contents of Jim Bennett's wallet? Because there were fingerprints recovered from the items that were taken out of the wallet and dropped on the forest floor. Those prints just didn't come from Jeff Titus, or from Jim Bennett for that matter. In fact, the person who left those prints has never been identified. Next time, on the final episode of our series on the case of Jeff Titus.
That's all for episode 15 of Undisclosed, The State vs. Jeff Titus. Next episode, episode 16, will be the last, for now, in our series on Jeff's case. And don't forget to send us your questions for this week's addendum episode on Thursday.
Amethyl Telhan is our executive producer. Our logo was designed by Baluki, and our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez. Audio production was done by Rebecca Lavoie of Partisan Crime Media and host of the Crime Writers On podcast. And music from this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions. Transcripts for episodes are available on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. They're brought to you by our amazing transcript team, Dom Logis, Britta Bliss, Skylar Park, and Erica Fladell. And of course, thank you to our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. You can follow us online, and on all social media, our handle is at UndisclosedPod. We're at Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any of our listeners out there have information on Jeff Titus' case that they'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com, or you can call and leave a message at 410-205-5563. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.